Phone check. 1, 2, the microphone check. 1, 2, 1, 2, the microphone check. I got my headphones tuned between two different AM stations, and my briefcase is full of declassified information. Declassified, declassified, and I'm reading it under the lens of your radio. I'm dissecting it and bleeding it. I read the world for breakfast, and after lunch I write it. I let me get me down, and then I stand back up and fight it. I read the news today, oh boy, oh boy. I know linguistics, statistics, pundits, and mystics. I voted for Ralph Nader. I read Docs and Raider. I got 1,000 signatures and sent them to Darth Vader. I'm reading U.S. News and World Report, Time Life, and The Post. I know more than other DJs because I read the most. And when I squint to the west, I can see Afghanistan. I put my head between my knees and I can see Iran. I get documents online and then I analyze them. They know I'm out there waiting, so they don't declassify them. I bug the White House and I bug the Pentagon. In the filling in my molar, I got my descrambler on. I got the truth. I got Paul Muth. We got better lines than Haydn Carruth. We put our 11 cents in, just like Marx and Lenin. Paul's like Carl McCartney, but I'm John Lennon. We'd love to turn you on. I say I want a revolution, and I want to stop it all. I finished all 3 volumes up of Marx's Capital. You know, everything that old boy wrote is up on my shelf, and every single bit I translated myself. I'm reading and I'm learning, and when the tide is turning, it'll warm my heart in part to see the dollar bills burning. They weren't built in a day, but all roads lead to Rome. I'll do fine just as the Romans with my main man, Rome. I'd like to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome whose name was Chomsky. I'm MCS of the Rook. I got a voice like milk. I'm the best dressed man you ever heard. Can you hear this tie? It's silk.
It's mid-morning on the last day of the week, and you're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Estabrook and Paul Muth discussing the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Archives of this show in free software formats are available at newsfromneptune.com. Thanks to the technical expertise of Dr. No, Jeff Nicholson Owens.
And a very happy birthday to Dr. No. Tomorrow, it seems to be birthdays seem to be the thing. Bill Gorell, proprietor of the Labor Hour, turned a major milestone, I think, yesterday. And Jeff, who
I
is
can't
but
guess.
A babe.
Is the 4-0 or the 5-0?
Hey, a man is ageless, you know, it's hard to tell. But in any case, there are a number of birthdays you and I are left out, I guess, Paul.
No, well, I'll have no one birthday. just because everybody else is.
You're going to have one just because everybody else? Okay, yeah, why not?
Movable feast. We're calling it a movable feast this time.
That sounds good.
There's already a religious intonation there.
Oh, I see. You're thinking, you know, birthdays in Lent, Mardi Gras and whatnot. This all goes together nicely.
About
that's
you're
a good point.
Going down to New Orleans to get your ashes down there after you party hardy. But apparently not. Uh-huh. That's a couple weeks away.
I'll probably make an ash of myself, but that happens. Yes.
Well, let's see what we can do about that today.
Yes.
Well, I'm glad we're starting
out. I know
it
would warm the cockles of your heart.
Because we could actually get out the South Dakota headline out of the way right away. Maybe that'll ruin the rest of our show. But what I haven't heard in the coverage is South Dakota already has a provision in their law about abortion and reproduction rights, is that if Roe v. Wade is overturned immediately, abortion becomes felonious in South Dakota. But they decided they wanted to provoke the Supreme Court ruling by passing this law that's now on the headlines of all the papers.
Well, and if there were any backbone at all in the Democratic Party, as much as there is in your average fetus, say, there would be
which is ludicrous physiologically to start with.
There would your fetuses don't have backbones? Come
not
on.
not for quite a while.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
We're talking mainly about blastules and embryos.
A lot of them seem to have them. But in any case, if the Democratic Party had any, it would take this discussion of abortion and the viewing with alarm of the courts and turn it into a pressed for what 80% of Americans actually want, which is a full health care system, the sort of things that the other industrialized countries have. But it's a remarkable testimony to the ability of our political system to suppress what is actually in the on the agenda of the American people. I mean, it's amazing. And on this, as on many other issues, the American populace is substantially to the left of either party.
Right. And there is grassroots efforts, the main effort to cover everybody. Again, I kind of question the idea of subsidizing people paying insurance companies. I really think that we ought to start at a little lower level and retrain insurance executives and personnel to actually do medical care as opposed to being in the insurance business, because I think there's plenty of health care.
I'm not following you at all.
Well,
you're making doctors out of my insurance agent has to go to med school?
Yeah, I think so, because if you look at where most of the health care money is spent in this country vis-a-vis other countries, mm-hmm. the overhead
right.
in the insurance industry is the problem. So if all those people were actually doing information technology vis-a-vis health issues as opposed to who's paying for who and who's going to deny who and et cetera, then we would actually have a much more effective and efficient healthcare system. But the main system, and what Blagojevich apparently is talking about with his All Kids programs, though he hasn't really lined it out much, is subsidizing people paying their insurance bills,
it's just a terrible subsidy for the insurance. It may be
an interim thing,
right.
but and what's happening in Maine, according to Now last night, is that they're figuring out how much of their money they're saving by avoiding paying for emergency rooms and demanding that the insurance company pony that up, because it's money that they have saved as well. But they want to keep it, as usual.
We just want to get the insurance companies out of the business entirely and run a national health care system that treats people on the basis of how sick they are, not how well off they or their insurance company is.
Yeah.
And there's no reason in the world that can't happen. And as you say, the vast overhead of our present amazingly inefficient system would be reduced immediately. And that's certainly doable. I mean, it's been tried out in the provinces, if the provinces are every other advanced industrialized country. So it's
well, and there's an upwelling from below, just like it happened in Canada, where Saskatchewan was the first unit of political organization up there that came up with a universal coverage plan. Not a socialist system in the sense that there are still private hospitals and private doctors and clinics and things, but the upwelling below is evidenced by both the Health Care Justice Act and the Campaign for Better Health Care. And I gather while I was out of town getting some health care, the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers had an event as well that was fairly well attended, and I had one review that it was quite good. There's a lot going on with so many people in this county not covered at all or having only Medicaid, and being turned down by the hospitals locally. Mm-hmm. I've heard that it's easier to get some Medicaid patients into Indianapolis than to try to get them into what are major health centers for this area in the form of Provena Covenant. And anyway, Champaign County Healthcare, you can Google them, and you can also look for the Campaign for Better Healthcare and look at that kind of activism. I don't think there are any. There was this public hearing fairly recently, so we did manage to finesse the abortion issue and go straight to health care, which is important, but they're not completely reducible.
Well, that's the remarkable cynicism and hypocrisy of Republicans and others who say they're opposed to abortion and, of course, do nothing effective, nothing at all, and certainly nothing effective in order to try to reduce it. And the effective thing to reduce it, as is clear from what experience we've had literally around the world in this matter, is the sort of health care support that most people... the absence of which leads the most people who have abortions to have them, and other forms of support, everything from education, housing, guaranteed annual income, the sorts of things that people feel they have to have an abortion in order to afford, all of these things should be provided by the very people who say they're opposed to abortion. There's no way you can be anti-abortion and not be a socialist, Paul.
Well, I don't think the converse is true, though, actually, as well, though. But I always...
Sure,
I like
socialists, people who like call themselves socialists, can believe in all sorts of things, as we know from centuries' experience.
I go back to Skinner versus Oklahoma, which is the case that started William O. Douglas on the idea that there was a right to reproductive autonomy for women. And it had to do with mandatory sterilization in Oklahoma. And I think just as you point out this contradiction in the so-called pro-lifers, that they don't seem to be pro-life after birth,
right,
that they also incorporate things like Depo Provera for welfare women, basically temporary sterilization, that if we do ignore the reproductive autonomy in the current situation, there are probably some states that might actually go to the extent of female sterilization, if it's chemical or otherwise.
Well, remember,
it's a worry.
Remember, sterilization as a social remedy was pioneered by the United States when the Nazis came to move in that direction in the 1930s, and they were dealing mainly with defective people. You know, that was their description. They drew on the both the ideas and the technical research that they got from the United States.
Yeah.
And of course the charter from the Supreme Court that allowed states to sterilize people throughout the first half of the 20th century was done by liberals. I mean, the best known liberal justice, the opinion was written by the best known liberal justice of the first half of the 20th century, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., that allowed states to sterilize people against their will. So we can expect that sort of support from the liberal tradition, because obviously sterilizing people makes the community better.
Well,
that was the argument.
Sure.
Three generations of idiots are enough. As Oliver Wendell Holmes quoted.
Social Darwinism was the remnant theory, and it was tied in with capitalism in a big way. It's a misinterpretation of Darwinism, actually. It isn't really survival of the fittest. It's survival of the fit. And if you find a niche, and if we are humane people, we can provide niches for all sorts of variously abled individuals, etc. So it's not, and that's what a technological society ought to be doing. It ought to be the social Darwinism, which is still regnant, and it comes up quite frequently with the bell curve and those kind of things like that, attributing so much to genetics.
It's important to remember, though, that the pressure for sterilization and the actual sterilization of tens of thousands of Americans came not from conservatives or rightists, but from progressives.
Well,
it was a progressive program, it was allowed, as I say, by the progressive court.
I think it was more complex than that. As usual on these issues, I find that you're a reductionist.
Reduction to the truth seems to be a good idea. Let's describe, call things by their right names. I have a faintly personal connection to this. The classic bit of sociological survey that buttressed the Supreme Court's opinion was done by a sociologist called Arthur Estabrook, distant cousin of mine. And it was his research research on this particular set of families that Holmes drew on to allow it.
He's in Wikipedia.
Something to make up for there. Reproductive autonomy, of course, is always an interesting phrase from the point of view of the unborn child. Reproductive autonomy, you know, is a bit Orwellian. Huh?
Yeah, well, calling a blastula an unborn child is a bit reductionist, too.
How about calling an eighth-month pregnancy an unborn child? I mean,
well,
the case that the court is actually considering is this very late-term abortion case, right?
Well, that's not... I was talking about South Dakota passing this new law.
Yes,
the court has granted cert on the entry of... Yeah, and the federal law...
Blastulas are not at stake.
Federal law has said that there is, you know, they've stipulated that there's no reason ever for that kind of procedure to take place. And there are doctors who were on the advisory committee that are anti-abortion and went back to the law who said, I actually might have to do it sometime because sometimes it is indicated. So Frist is making it up and because he's a surgeon or something. I mean, they're stipulating things that are not scientifically true in that law, and that may be where it falls apart.
I guess the court will have to determine that, huh? I mean, they will consider just what the science is on this, and the sureties of the pro-abortion party, you know, may not be so sure when the arguments actually occur.
Well, I guess it'll be a battle of the outside experts, and neither of us are in that field. But I've read what I think I need to know to say that, you know, it's not something one wants to do. But there are cases of hyperencephalia and things like that where that kind of procedure has to take place.
Well, thank you, Dr. Muth, but I think the fact still remains that the political question here is the one that I wish was being talked about, and that is the question that both Democrats and Republicans are ducking as rapidly as they possibly can, in spite of a large constituency of Americans out there for sort of health care that really would reduce abortions.
Health care reform is a good in and of itself for all the people that are sentient and fully living right now.
That's what you have to do to get into the system.
You don't have to even be bringing up the issue. Anyway, that's about 15 minutes on.
I thought you brought up the issue.
I did.
Ah.
I thought it was reasonable to do. We didn't talk about Roe v. Wade on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade because we were pretty much consonant on opposing Alito on all of the myriad other issues that were important.
There were plenty of reasons to oppose Alito, exactly.
Given what's gone before the court and what South Dakota's trying to provoke, probably tactically incorrect, has been pointed out, and might actually backfire on them. But there are so many other broader issues that we should get to, like
Arguments about this are a wonderful diversion. I mean, the way that a number of the pro-abortion groups, you know, congratulated Joe Lieberman and others for voting against Alito was just remarkable, Paul. I mean, it was reminiscent of those feminist groups, you know, who refused to attack Bill Clinton refused to support the impeachment of Bill Clinton, you know, because he was pro-abortion. I mean, this is a particularly sad.
There were many other reasons.
Example.
He was much better on women's issues of all sorts of other issues.
So
than
it's
the
okay.
Administration.
So perjury is all right if he's okay on the issues that you're concerned about, huh?
Well, I think that we have agreed in the past that Clinton should have been impeached for a number of other actions, like maybe bombing Kosovo or something.
And Alito
like that.
should have been defeated for a number of other actions either. And the senators who were being praised for voting against him did not do the effective thing, which is support a filibuster against him, and they're nevertheless being praised by Narrell and Now and groups of that sort. That's pretty sad politics, it seems to me.
Well, it's the politics of the present, and it's very sad, and we have a lot of other sad politics to review.
Politics
and
of the present.
What I was suggesting is that we should talk about this, but since it's now consumed a third of the show, I was suggesting that maybe we could agree to disagree and move on to some other
politics
issues.
Politics of the present is a wonderful phrase that was used by the State Department this week, and you know who they were talking about? They're talking about the ex-president, as he is now of Haiti, Aristide. When the U.S. was asked about when the U.S. State Department was asked what it had to say about the new president of Haiti, René Préval, saying that, of course, Aristide was free to return. The State Department refused to answer about Aristide because, quote, Aristide is from the past. We're dealing with the politics of the
present. It's an extremely loose paraphrase of what I said to connect the two, but let's go on to Haiti
exactly what they were saying. They were talking about, you know, the politics
of
the present.
I'm just saying that's what exists right now, and it includes the history. I'm not denying history like the State Department would like. Amelia Shaw, who I pointed out last week, is a stringer from Haiti for NPR. Wow, she's also on payroll of Voice of America. It's ridiculous that it's going on, and people should write NPR and say, can't you afford to have another correspondent who isn't working for the propaganda arm of the U.S. government, like the Voice of America? She had a long piece, was yesterday, the day before, in which she cites somebody from the Haiti, quote somebody, actually has an actuality quote from somebody from the Haiti Democracy Project, which is edifice of the National Endowment for Democracy, which is Orwellian as you can get.
It is indeed.
And what he says is Préval was over Haiti when democracy died or something to that. That's a loose paraphrase, but it was something on the effect, which is the absolutely asinine thing to say. A country that has a history of coups like Haiti, just three in the last couple of decades, to call Préval, who was just too close to Aristide and was prime minister when Aristide should have been president, filling out the length of his term rather than the chronological date, was just absolutely surreal. And again, I urge people to write NPR and say, you can't have a propagandist for VOA. I'd like to know if anybody's out there. I know there are a lot of people that are angry about this, but apparently not enough for NPR to pay any attention, who are looking at her, comparing her coverage that gets aired on VOA to her coverage that gets aired on NPR, and how much overlap there is.
Well, maybe at the same time they could do something regarding the political situation in Haiti somewhat more directly by writing representatives, senators, and the State Department about the current situation, which is not working out in the way that the American government had in mind. I mean, the American government thought it had scotched the reform movement in Haiti by getting rid of Aristide, and now they have a president who is elected in part because of the failure of the U.S. and its creatures to control this particular election. This election got out of hand. I mean, there's certain similarities to the Haitian election and the certain similarities between the Haitian election and the April 2002 coup in Venezuela. In both cases, the U.S. tried to manipulate the chief executive of a Western Hemisphere country and produce one to their own liking, and they were prevented essentially by a popular uprising, both in Venezuela and indeed in Haiti. And so now we have a number of these groups, such as the ones you've mentioned, the groups associated with the National Endowment for Democracy and these international institutes set up by the Republican and Democratic right. Party, all claiming that, yes, the election was stolen, Préval has stolen the election. What they meant was that
they weren't able to choreograph
the American attempt to steal it didn't work. And so there's going to be more to this story. And it seems the player in some way in the midst of it was the Brazilian troops and the OAS ambassador, who is a Chilean. The U.S. thought that it had essentially Latin American governments doing its dirty work in Haiti for it. And a lot of people were shaking their head with dismay about what the Brazilian government was allowing its troops to do in Haiti, including, in one case at least, shooting up the Cité du Soleil, the slum area on the edge of which included a lot of Aristide supporters. But it looks like these folks, in fact, said to the American manipulators of the election, look, Préval is clearly the choice of the people, and he must be president.
Yeah, it's a poison pill that they're already invoking. I thought it would go along a little later, that, they give him a tainted election, when actually the real story was how the election was trying to be stolen.
Yeah.
And speaking of the Brazilian forces, there is the story of the Brazilian commander who shot himself in the head, in part.
If that's what happened.
Well, I think it was. I think he was tormented by the position he was in and what he was having to do.
I think we don't know, but what we do know, as you say, is that the head of these Brazilian forces who were in this peculiar position, not to put too fine a point on it, in Haiti, turns up dead, and it's described as a suicide. Well, perhaps it was, but...
Well, the war of words between Chavez and the U.S., and it's being characterized in another way he's the guy that's what did he do? He restricted the number of flights from a variety of American airlines. Turns out that the grievance they have predates him. There's a 10-year-old opposition by the U.S. for flights of the Venezuelan airlines, and so that he's the one who has the prior grievance, and they've been working on it for quite a while, trying to say, well, why can't you guys fly into Caracas all the time? Why can't we fly our get more flights into Miami? And that's, but anyway, also the apparently the American Family Institute is not ready to call for his head on a platter like Robertson is. Chavez, we're talking about, but is calling for a boycott of Citgo, and of course we've been on the record here calling for a boycott of Citgo. So if you want to gas yourself with Venezuelan the fruit of Venezuelan petroleum, which is the, as Naomi Klein has said, the only place in the world where petrodollars and money from oil is actually benefiting the poor. And most everywhere else in the world, you have comprador regimes that are ready to. And of course, we have that in spades in the Persian Gulf and the Gulf states. And I guess we'll have to talk about who's manning our ports at some point.
Our friend and colleague Dave Johnson has a suggestion of how one should reply to this American Family Institute attempt to call for a boycott of Citgo. They have a petition going, and he'll give you the URL where you can write and give your own opinion of what the cheap gas that Venezuela is providing to poor people in the U.S. Should properly be. One point about the Venezuela thing that I thought was just lovely this week was that Secretary of State Rice, on a tour of the Middle East, where she was receiving the cold shoulder from
Condi flops.
From these people who are supposed to be. I mean, the problem in Venezuela, as the problem in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, is what happens when you have a government that stops following orders from Washington. And this isn't happening in a big way in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, but just enough to be embarrassing for Rice. I'd like to come back to that because that refers to, she was talking particularly about Israel and the Palestinian. And the Palestinian Authority. But in the midst of it, she gives this news conference. She talks to reporters about how that, they're really promoting democracy. They're promoting democracy around the world. For example, she says, we have to promote democracy in Venezuela over against the Chavez dictatorship. For example, we're supporting the truckers' strike in Venezuela. And people looked at that and said, that's very interesting. Truckers' strike, that takes you back, sort of like Chile. When there's a truckers' strike when the U.S. overthrew the government in Chile. And so the only problem was that poor staff work for Ms. Rice, the truckers' strike hasn't broken out yet. There was no truckers' strike. And in fact, as a result of Rice's comments, there's a demonstration of truckers in Caracas, in Venezuela, before the American embassy saying, what the hell are you trying to do? You're trying to set up a strike against our government. We support this government.
If these people weren't so powerful and doing already so much evil things in the world, that'd be funny.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. And this is a wonderful, the Venezuelan trucker strike was a beautiful example with Rice has egg all over her face. And
they must have gone back to the how it worked under Kissinger and the Chile file. Let's see, what can we do?
How precisely about a trucker strike? That's exactly right. And the problem is, I think they got their timing off. There's actually American agents are in Venezuela. They're trying to stir up a strike, and the strike was scheduled maybe for the end of February, and they haven't got it together yet. But unfortunately, no one briefed Rice correctly.
Should announce it in advance.
Push this off for 2 weeks till we get this thing going.
Well, if you want to compare Chile to Venezuela in this case, the other thing that the U.S. was doing, the two-track policy, was arming, getting ready for Allende.
Absolutely.
And they don't have a comparable situation in Venezuela.
Well, it took them a while to find one. They had to kill the head of the armed forces in Chile in order to get Pinochet to the point where he could become the America's man in Chile. They had people like this lined up for the coup in Venezuela in 2002. In fact, it was quite remarkable about how gently those people have been treated by the Venezuelan government. They'll look for others. What's also remarkable about this, Paul, is the lack of imagination the American government shows. I mean, as you say, they pull out the coup book from Chile and say, here's how to do it.
Well, there aren't that many clever ways to do that, it seems to me. It reminds me that I was to announce at some point that, and we're about at the announcement phase here, that the film called The Trial of Henry Kissinger, the guy that made that film, which is kind of based on Hitchens' book work to some extent, though I don't think it's entirely, has a new film out on the military-industrial complex called Why We Fight, and it won the Sundance Documentary Prize. Maybe this is my Oscar... Oscar mode. I hadn't thought of it in those terms that I was making this filmic announcement. But
this is the guy who has said that he supports McCain as president.
Yeah. I did notice that McCain gets a place in this too.
Dear,
so you have to be suspicious.
Terrible.
And obviously, the thing is called the Eisenhower Project too. So he's trying to harken back to when the Republicans were good and great. But we've reviewed the Eisenhower sleepy days of the Eisenhower years and found that there was a lot
not
of
so sleepy,
skullduggery exactly. and coups going on. Right. You know, what do we got? We got Iran.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the roots of what's going on in Iran right now.
But it also points
and,
out.
And, of course, Guatemala.
The fact that there is a great deal of dismay with this war and this administration on the right in this country, and this movie sort of points that up, too. I mean, there has been all along, although it hasn't been reported, it has been all along in the so-called paleo conservatives, that area of the right which has proposed the war on principle from the beginning. Find in journals like the American Conservative and Chronicles and things of this sort, and hates the neocon impulse in American foreign policy. But what we're seeing is more and more people who, as you know, see themselves as Republicans or coming out of a Republican tradition or a rightist tradition and so forth, saying something is profoundly wrong. And we haven't even mentioned the Dubai ports yet.
Yeah, well, we're getting to that.
You're listening to News from Neptune, Carlos DeBrook and Paul Muth talking about the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Shall we turn to the Dubai ports world story?
I haven't gone through Pratap Chatterjee's Corp Watch article yet. Amy had him on for a short piece, and it looks looks really good. But yeah, I think Krugman and both Greider, they take the attitude, well, this is like the chickens coming home to roost. If you're going to rule by scaring the world about the Muslim threat and the Islamic terror, and then well, we don't really mean that. Not when it comes
exactly.
to do with business.
Well, now we're talking business.
Yeah, you know, it's like
I think you're exactly right. I mean, it's an amazing story. I've been talking about this tension, if to put no finer point on it, between looters and killers in the second Bush administration. And in a sense, I mean, it's not even not always separate individuals, as you point out. The impulses are combined in a number of people involved in this administration. But the impulses themselves are at war with each other. I mean, and here we have, I think, just an amazing example. It's a remarkably inept bit of behavior on the part of the Bush administration. But here they are having, while the neocon side, the killer side of the administration is out screaming about the global extremist Islamic empire, the business side, the looter side, is perfectly happy to do deals. Of course it is. Well, why not? I mean, Dubai is the New York of the 21st century, as they say.
Well, apparently it's true that Snow has a financial interest. He sold a share of a firm that he was, I don't know if he was CEO.
Treasury Secretary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Treasury Secretary Snow, who was on the committee that authorized it. In fact, it met under their auspices. He has CSX connections, and CSX was sold to the British company that was now being bought by Dubai Ports, and he has deferred compensation, just like Cheney has from Halliburton. Yeah. It goes up all the time when their stock goes up. He has deferred compensation from CSX stock from this historic thing. So, you know, theoretically, if we weren't in the year of hypercronyism, he should have recused himself from discussing it. But I'm not saying that it was that reduce it,
exactly.
because they're acting at all in it's their class interest.
There
even if they, even if he didn't have that direct connection, he would still be inclined to say, well, and you know, and the Pentagon loves Dubai. This is an old smuggling port from years ago. They've been good at moving things subtly and unsubtly. Now they're pretty much legit, but. The Chatterjee on CorpWatch.org goes through and talks about all the myriad contracts and how much of the armament and stuff that's supporting the Iraq war effort is going through that particular port. So these people are very reliable, and they just can't seem to explain that to the public after scaring the hell out of everybody.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, the propaganda for this war, and centered as it is in the Pentagon, suddenly comes up contradictory to the business interest, and as you rightly say, the class interests of the people that are running the central government. And the contradiction is amazing. And it's, I mean, the fact that they've allowed this to happen sort of by inadvertence is further testimony to the disarray that the Bush administration finds itself in. Now, that's not necessarily a good thing. An administration in this sort of disarray is capable of some pretty horrible things. For example, who do you think blew up the Golden Mosque in Samarra?
It would be a good question, wouldn't it?
I mean,
doesn't look like a Zarqawi operation.
Exactly.
Because it was too too well done. It looks like a special ops operation.
It certainly does.
Now, whether it's the old Bathurst special ops who were quite talented, or whether, you know, but who does it serve? As far as people declaiming an internecine confessional war like this, the divide and conquer is a long tradition, as we reviewed last week, and the U.S. You know, far from opposing this, you know, it makes sure that we stay there. You know,
exactly.
There's more reason to stay than there ever has been.
Well,
you have Frontline showing testimony from one of the good operatives in the Iraqi army, you know, insisting that we have to stay there. So PBS is on board with stay the course.
Yeah, I mean, none of this is definite, Paul. And I mean, who actually did blow up this mosque? And this mosque is an extremely important mosque for the Shia tradition. I mean, that's the mosque associated with particularly for the so-called 12er Shias, the 12th disappeared imam. And this, I mean, it in terms of, it's clearly a bit of propaganda of the deed, so to speak. You know, this action was meant to say something, not to do something. And so the first question to ask is the one that you suggest, cui bono, whose interests are served by this activity? And the interests, it's difficult not to come round to the notion that the interests primarily are those of the United States, not of the Shia parties or of the Sunni parties in Iraq, nor indeed almost anybody else. This makes it at least a suspicious affair.
Well, and I can't rule out that kind of grave malfeasance. Maybe a lot of people do, but you don't even have to buy that was the case. But the U.S., what it's been doing through its various interventions, Khalilzad and crew, playing the two parties off against each other, this looks like it's calculated to define everything in these terms to begin with. So
the oldest rule of imperialists is divide et impera, divide and conquer. And this is this looks off. Now, and there's several ways also to read this. I mean, the man you mentioned, Khalilzad, the American ambassador to Iraq, who is in fact an Afghani Sunni, is said just before this event in Samarra, look, the groups in Iraq have got to get together and form an effective government or we'll leave.
Nice threat. Maybe they should take him up.
Well, exactly. And we know, as I say, it's difficult to read, you know, the wheels within wheels here. But we have this long history of talk of the Salvador options, the establishment of death squads, the activities of Stephen Cambone's wing of the Pentagon, who is, Rumsfeld's enforcer, you know. We have things like those the British soldiers who are captured in Basra, dressed in local dress and clearly involved in some sort of black flag operation. It's hard to believe the U.S. is not doing things like this. We've put together an Iraqi National Guard. Talk about imperial parallels, the sort of things the U.S. did in Nicaragua, for example, you know, a century ago. We put together an Iraqi National Guard who are supposed, you know, who are our creatures, and the people who blew up the mosque in Samarra were supposed to have been in uniform. They placed bombs and moved away. They didn't, suicide operations. Several of the other attacks since then have been remote controlled car bombs, not suicide actions and so forth. I mean, the MO looks like the Pentagon, and the much more importantly, the interest being served by it, depending upon how you might read them, can be understood to be American.
Well, special ops was taught to some of the Baathist regime by by the U.S. Well, some years
and
ago.
We're busy teaching it to the National Guard that we're setting up there right now. So I mean, yeah, that's.
I was looking at Juan Cole's informed comment on that, and he thinks Sistani is actually threatening to deploy his militia, which he hasn't done so far. And we have the irony of Bush naming only Sistani as being a good actor in the instance. It seems like he may not have been fully briefed as well.
Well, Bush had a funny phrase. He gave a speech to the American Legion. I mean, remember, the only place Bush can speak these days is carefully controlled military or semi-military operations. But he gave a speech this week that included the phrase that Iraq was on the moment of choosing, sort of euphonious phrase that our president is famous for. But what could that possibly mean?
Moment of our choosing, maybe.
Well, I think what it means is that the Pentagon is setting up an operation by encouraging these this intercommunal strife in Iraq so that it can act the way it wants to. One of the things it wants to do is be able to withdraw troops. And if Khalilzad was setting that up, we can imagine the Pentagon saying, well, we've done what we can. We're pulling back to certain bases where we can control some of the major major strong points in Iraq and do something about controlling the oil resources. But we've simply given up on trying to bring security to Iraq because the people don't want it. They've got to do themselves. Iraq is at the moment of choosing, and they have unfortunately have chosen civil war. You can write the speech right now. You know, the people who are in the Pentagon whose job it is to come up with stuff like this, are working night and day to make sure that it'll be ready when the Pentagon needs it.
Might be a good point. I was out of town when the town meeting happened. Maybe you have a little review of that, and then I don't suppose you might know when it's going to be replayed on the cable. I assume that it was. There's some confusion as to whether it was cable cast live or whether it's just going to be repeated.
We're talking
this
about the fact
that town meeting.
Yeah. That there was a town meeting in Urbana urging the city council to pass a resolution for withdrawal. The interesting thing here, of course, is that this is occurring across the country. I mean, literally hundreds of cities and towns across the U.S. are doing things like that, and it's certainly worthwhile for Champaign and Urbana to get with the program. I mean, this is as the recent polls show, this expresses the views of now a substantial majority of Americans. So it's
Chicago City Council has already passed
they
it,
have indeed.
From what I understand.
That's quite right.
I made a call out promoting it the day I was leaving town on Tuesday to the local Yokel News Gazette channel, and luckily I was already on the phone with somebody who was railing about sort of a paleocon railing against the National Guard being out of the country.
Yep.
And saying they're designed to protect the homeland and take care of things here like Katrina and other things like that. So I mentioned that the history of the New England town meetings where they actually decide things substantively, though in this case they didn't.
Buying David Souter's house, for example.
Vermont. In Vermont, this was not a binding thing, but the town meetings in Vermont just said that they wanted their National Guard to come home from.
Yep.
From it kind of fell on deaf ears, but as far as the radio host and probably some of the listeners, maybe they didn't understand where I was coming at. But it was interesting to hear this kind of paleocon, you know, what is the National Guard
yep.
doing over there anyway? I pointed out that, you know, this dates back to the Montgomery Amendment, who was a Democrat from Alabama, if I recall, during the Reagan era. That's when the National Guard was authorized to be federalized without the, you know, express signing on by the governors, and that's when they were used in Central America.
It goes back to Vietnam. I mean, a number of the governors, including Governor Dukakis of Massachusetts, tried to prevent their state National Guards from being deployed. In Dukakis' case, it was to Central America.
Yeah.
But that goes back to even earlier arguments about the National Guard in Vietnam. In each case, Dukakis' attempt to keep the Massachusetts National Guard from going to Central America during the Reagan Wars of the 80s went to the Supreme Court, as I recall, and the court essentially said, well, all this talk about state National Guard is very nice, but it's actually run by the federal government.
Yeah. The Montgomery Amendment made it Congress said that we can federalize the National Guard, so maybe that needed to be tested as well.
This was the same court that was saying, of course, that the right to keep and bear arms in the Second Amendment was fulfilled by the existence of the state National Guard units. I mean, that was the people's right to keep and bear arms. The National Guard had them. So, yes.
Well, there's still so many...
A long history there.
So many things on the list here, too.
Let me say one more thing. I want to get back to the question of the bombings in Iraq and the terrible carnage that has occurred as a result, and if indeed these are black operations by the special ops, black flag operations by the U.S. government. That's even, well, just adds to the horror. There was... and by the way, in terms of the, and this is hardly a by the way, in terms of the way the war is being conducted, there's a very interesting article on the front page of our local paper today, in which a local judge talks about basically torturing prisoners when he was a young army interrogator in the Vietnam War. You have to read between the pages, read between the lines a bit. The headline is "Ideals Clash with Survival in War." Well, what he actually describes is the sort of the sort of torture that we now know is commonplace in the American Army in Iraq.
He was with Operation Phoenix.
But I also
who knows?
I also wanted to talk about the fact that the reason that one might think that the U.S. is doing particularly wretched things in terms of special operations in Iraq is not just the extra money that's being asked for by the Pentagon right now for special operations. It's a major, major element in their new budget. But this event in Saudi Arabia, there was an attack, apparently a suicide bomb attack, it's always difficult to tell, on the world's largest oil refinery, basically, what the Wall Street Journal calls the most vital cog in world petroleum.
Well, they were blown up on the access road,
in a place called,
no question, no knowing how they were planning on
in a place called Abqaiq in Saudi Arabia. And Abqaiq is this major refinery area. Now, the U.S. looking at this situation sees that this area is the Shiite area of Saudi Arabia. So you have Iran, a pro-Iran Shiite government in Iraq, and the Shiite areas controlling most of the oil in Saudi Arabia. We also heard
not controlling; they're there.
Well, the
control
Shiite
is
areas.
Obviously by the people that we put
control
in.
Right? The control is by the Saudi government, but the oil is located in the Shiite areas in Saudi Arabia. Now, there was an interesting story this week about the Marines. This was in the Financial Times. The Marines are looking for studies of ethnicities in the oil-producing areas of Iran. Now, the notion here is that Marines wanted to know if perhaps they could find disaffected groups in the oil-producing regions of Iran. What the U.S. is most afraid of here is exactly what it seems to have produced, an area of Shiite political consciousness that controls most of the world's oil production. And the U.S. will move heaven and earth to break up what these unintended consequences of its own policy, I fear.
Well, and that goes back historically to the fact that the U.S. was promoting, the Islamic fundamentalists against the secular nationalists,
sure, right.
As we recounted again last week, and it's also true in Hamas. Hamas was a counterweight that was funded by the Israeli military authorities in the West Bank and Gaza as a counterbalance to the then secular PLO. The chickens come home to roost.
Well, this brings us back to Ms. Rice, Secretary of State in Hamas this week. I mean, the point of her trip throughout the Levant seems to be to convince Arab governments not to support Hamas, and it's failed, as you mentioned. It's failed utterly. Even Egypt, who is a client state of the United States as a result of Jimmy Carter's Camp David arrangements, even Egypt said, that this isn't going to work. I enjoyed the commentator from the Daily Star in Lebanon, who said on NPR this week that Ms. Rice's trip was imbecilic.
Yeah.
I thought that was quite nice.
He prefaced it by saying, I don't like to say this.
Exactly.
But it was imbecilic.
But it's pretty dumb. And so, because, in fact, you know, here the U.S. is once again caught in its own contradictions, supporting democracy, but when it gets some, it doesn't like the result. And we realize when the U.S. says democracy, it means a government that will follow orders. And they're worried that Hamas will not follow orders, as they wanted all those years Fatah to do. But I was delighted to see, delighted isn't quite the right word because the situation is quite horrible, but I mean it just testified to the disarray in the American government in this issue, that in that black hole of the Newsweek, that period, the end of Friday, beginning of Saturday and so forth, where governments like to hide things, particularly our government likes to hide things by announcing them, an assistant secretary of state by the name of David Welch said very quietly to a few reporters, well, of course, aid to the Palestinian, aid to Palestine will continue, and we really didn't mean it when we said we were going to keep back all their money. So,
well, Condi said humanitarian aid will continue.
That's right.
What I want to know is
she
who...
She never did. It was David Welch who did.
Had to clarify.
That's right.
Who was the one vote in the House that voted against the...
Oh, I had that.
Was it Ron Paul? Or
no, I thought it was Paul. I thought it would have been Paul, too. No, it was Neil Abercrombie, who is... where is he from? Someplace odd, like
we're talking about like the sense of the House resolution, yep, that no money be sent to the Palestinian Authority because of Hamas's takeover.
Well, I'd have to check. Let me check that. I'm not sure.
It may not have been entirely to it. Maybe they did did have a proviso about.
Right.
And since it was a resolution, I guess they didn't feel like they had to be entirely careful. But it was a sense of the House, and that's and then people don't understand how differently people see things. But then if we've been given propaganda, we have NPR, Linda Gradstein, is it?
No.
Talking about
the
Israelis are operating in a refugee camp in the West Bank. It kept being repeated. There was no sense of describing what the operation was. It was just operation. They're operating in the refugee camp. I mean, it drove me crazy to hear this constantly being repeated. You know what are they doing? What are they doing there? You know, it doesn't have to be. Doesn't have to be explained because, of course, they have entirely have the right to do it, right?
I thought,
dig that one out.
I know you have some other things on your list, and I have a long list here too. I don't know. Did you? I sort of expected you, Paul. I hesitate to bring this up, but I sort of expected you to bring it up. I thought perhaps you'd like to say something about the president of Harvard, the soon-to-be ex-president.
Well, he's on my list, but it isn't really high up. Maybe about Red Ken getting his hand slapped over in Britain,
the mayor of London.
I think his major offense was calling Sharon a war criminal. Actually, is why he's made so many people angry. He apparently had some derisive remarks about a Jewish reporter who he didn't like, and he compared him to a concentration camp guard, which is a little curious.
But
and I kind of had to be there, I guess, to understand the whole context.
But you think it would be protected speech in the area of protected speech.
We got
how about the David Irving case?
Yeah.
That seems to me to be
something
just
he said
amazing.
In 1989.
Yeah, I mean, he's picked up. He's stopped on the highway in Austria, you know, and they kept him in jail all winter. He's been there since November. They bring him out of jail and then they sentence him to 3 years for denying the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's an amazing, and the prosecutors in Austria are saying, well, 3 years isn't enough. He needs a longer prison sentence than that now. So, I mean, boy, there are times when you realize that the United States really is in advance of the rest of the world in terms of free speech. I mean, that's one of the areas in which we have
to
say
quite
well.
Well, we have our corporate media that controls the flow so much that we don't have to worry about some draconian laws.
But we forget how bad the European states are, all of them, on questions of free speech. Now, I will say, with that said, that there is this case of this fellow Rodney Coronado, who has been arrested and is held in jail at the moment for a speech he gave 3 years ago that supposedly offended by describing how to make an incendiary device. He is supposed to be a member of the Earth Liberation Front, but he's not being charged with any activity. He's charged with giving a speech. And this is quite outrageous, Paul. I mean, mm-hmm. if this is allowed to stand, then the American claim to lead the world in terms of protection of free speech will disappear rather quickly.
Well, like I say, I think it's kind of it's a de jure kind of stance. De facto, we have a press that's completely manipulative.
Well, so ideological control and control of the press and so forth is different from effective free speech. And the U.S. is certainly
when the rubber hits the road. I mean,
it's a different matter. Yeah. The laws against free speech are substantial in Britain, France, Germany, throughout the EU. The U.S. is much freer on these matters than those countries are. This is not to say that we have. I mean, they have their own forms of ideological control, and the U.S. forms are particularly advanced because it depends. Because they have to work in a society which does have a strong tradition of free speech.
And, well, you wonder whether the U.S. is having any impact when there's a Turkish film that characterizes the U.S. in Iraq in very gruesome sorts of ways, and it's showing in Germany, and there's some sense that the Germans might use these laws that we're referring to quash it, calling it some kind of hate speech.
Right.
But you wonder whether they haven't gotten a call from some mid-level foreign service person, saying, can't you do something about this? So, we're willing to use. I think the U.S. is probably willing to use those laws. And like I said, we don't need them here.
Oh, of course.
We've got this.
Well, it's not quite
system
like
of ideological
there
control.
There are other things that have to be done. I mean, I think there's always a danger of minimizing people's victories. And there are real victories in the American struggle for civil rights. So.
We only have a second left. This was on my bullet point last week. It's sort of a free speech issue. The Gonzo Attorney General Gonzalez is going to place limits on testimony of former Attorney General John Ashcroft and the James Comey, the guy that put the kibosh on the eavesdropping for at least a small time, the warrantless spying business. But so we have national security, which is a great crimp on any kind of free speech, obviously.
We've left out one of the most important stories for the week, and that's all the stories about the American torture system, the FBI's revelations about Gitmo, Human Rights Watch description of deaths in custody in U.S. prisons in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, horrible things are going on here
in our name, and we haven't
had a chance really to get to those. We really should.